Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last week, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer told Politico that Democrats will deny Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch the 60 votes he needs to clear a Senate filibuster. The move would force Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to choose the nuclear option. Senator Schumer said, quote, "There's been an almost seismic shift in the caucus against Gorsuch. He did not win anybody over with his testimony," end quote. So what did we learn in his testimony? He refused to answer repeated questions about cases like Citizens United and Roe v. Wade, but he has a long record. According to a New York Times analysis, Judge Gorsuch is more conservative than Supreme Court Justices John Roberts, Samuel Alito, and the late Justice Antonin Scalia. Judge Gorsuch is only 49 years old, so if he is confirmed, he will have a profound impact on the country's political, social, and legal landscape for decades to come. How will the court shift if Judge Gorsuch is confirmed? Joining us today are two guests. Billy Courier is Deputy Director of Legal Progress at American Progress. His work focuses on courts, the law, and the influence of judicial elections and campaign contributions on judges. And Billy Courier joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Billy. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. And Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of Rewire, an online publication focusing on sexual and reproductive health, rights, and justice. Hi, Jody. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Billy, I want to start off with you talking about some of the news that's just coming in. Last week, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said that Democrats will deny Gorsuch the 60 votes he needs. But now Senator Patrick Leahy is saying, "I am not inclined to filibuster, even though I'm not inclined to vote for Gorsuch." He told a Vermont news outlet this. So what do you think? What should we make of this?
Well, I think that Senator Leahy, he's been on the Judiciary Committee a very long time. And I think he's a bit of a traditionalist when it comes to the Senate and some of the, longstanding traditions of the Senate, including the filibuster. So I think that's what's going on there. But it's clear that, when he looked at Judge Gorsuch's record, and as well as, Judge Gorsuch's answers or non-answers during his confirmation hearing, that, he understood that Judge Gorsuch's vision of the law is not going to be what's good for America.
Jody, The Hill is also reporting that most members of the Democratic caucus's progressive wing said that they will vote no, but 10 Democrats up for re-election in states that were carried by Donald Trump have stayed on the fence. So what do you make of all of this?
Well, I make of that those Democrats are not reliable in terms of what's going to happen with Gorsuch, and that it's going to take a lot of work of the kind we've seen over the past month or two by grassroots activists and indivisible groups and others to really keep the Democrats in line. I think we're in a new era. The grassroots is energized around these things, and Democrats both in the House and the Senate need to realize that the threat is not only from the right, but that they need to uphold progressive principles. This man is not just a replacement for Scalia. He is, by all counts, worse than Scalia. And I think it's really, it's time for Democrats to stand up for basic rights and principles and stop playing politics with women's lives, particularly, and with other kinds of rights like voting rights.
And the vote, according to reports, is going to be next Monday, April 3rd. On that point, Jody, Jeffrey Toobin has a piece in The New Yorker called "Behind Neil Gorsuch's Non-Answers." And he writes, "It is clear that Neil Gorsuch is not Merrick Garland. That was President Obama's choice to fill Scalia's seat." And he writes, "When Scalia died, more than 11 months remained in Obama's presidency. Republicans refused to give his nominee a hearing. This departure from norms was all the more outrageous because the tactic was used to block a moderate. Merrick Garland was a moderate. The Republicans denied Obama his constitutional right in order to trade a justice who might have been less liberal than Stephen Breyer for one who might be as radical as Clarence Thomas. And according to a New York Times analysis of Gorsuch's record, he is more conservative than Justices John Roberts and Samuel Alito and the late Justice Antonin Scalia. The New York Times put him just below Clarence Thomas. How do you analyze Gorsuch? When you look at what Jeffrey Toobin said about how that seat could have been filled with Garland, and then Gorsuch's record compared to the justices on the court now, the conservative justices.
That was to me?
Yes, Jody.
You know, look, I think that we know that this is an incredibly, you know, to say conservative, it's really radical fundamentalist conservative. We use the words Democrat, Republican, conservative, liberal. I don't even think they really describe what we're seeing anymore, especially in the radical right wing of the Republican Party. And here we have a man who, you know, ostensibly, at least, according to several people in his class, once suggested that it was not only okay, but that employers should basically profile women for whether or not they might have children before hiring them, that it would be okay to have corporations have rights that supersede the individuals who are in their employ, that health rights are subject to the quote-unquote religious rights of corporations. These are really dramatic changes, and they're dramatic threats to public health, to voting rights, to science. And so I think that we have a situation where I don't believe, and I know others will argue with me, that the Democrats or Obama did enough or made enough out of what happened with Garland to really make it into the issue it should have been. I think it was absolutely disgusting what happened with Garland, but now that it has happened and we're in this situation, the Democrats should find every manner, every means they can to block this nomination. Especially given what we now know about the potential investigations of several people in the White House or affiliated with President Trump.
Billy, what do you think?
No, I think that's absolutely right, especially that last point. I mean, you know, we've got the FBI director testifying last week at the same time as Judge Gorsuch that the administration is under investigation for possible collusion with the Russians during the campaign last year. And we've never had a president who gets a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court when they're under an FBI investigation. So I think that now is the time to kind of put the brakes on all this and just slow down and say, hey, can we find out, you know, what's going on with this FBI investigation before we let this president leave, you know, his mark on the Supreme Court for decades?
A few Democratic senators are calling for that, but how would that work?
Well, you know, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, I think the only thing that we're trying to say is there's no reason to rush this process. You know, Senator Grassley and Senator McConnell want to get this nomination through next week,
right,
which is very fast. And, you know, we saw what happened with Jeff Sessions, the attorney general. They also rushed his confirmation process. And then we found out only later about these contacts with the Russians during the campaign. I don't think that Neil Gorsuch had any contact with the Russians, but I think it would be wise to just be cautious and slow down and kind of take our time with this.
Jody, what options do the Democrats have at this point?
Well, you know, the reality is that we're looking at either not having 60 votes or or a filibuster, or the Republicans going for the so-called nuclear option. I'm not really sure. I was unfortunately away last week, and so I missed a good part of the hearings and some of the political stuff going around it. I understand that today's judiciary hearing was postponed, unless I'm wrong, and so that would be next Monday. So it's slowed
right
down a little bit, if I'm correct, and you guys should correct me if I'm wrong.
No, that's right. It's going to be on April 3rd. That's the latest.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I think they need to use every means necessary, and I do know that they have some means. Now, I also think that there ought to be, and I'm going to use the term strong-arming, of Democrats that might fold, because there's no excuse for Democrats, especially, you know, including those like Michael Bennett from Colorado, who espouse to want to protect women's rights, to want to protect voting rights, et cetera, but then to go along with voting for Gorsuch. it's not a matter of whether or not he's smart or he is, you know, a good lawyer, quote-unquote. It's a matter of his values and principles. It's a matter of his evasiveness, and it's a matter of the basic rights of the people of this country. And I think this judge cannot protect them, especially out of what we've seen of the Roberts Court so far in its leanings toward giving, you know, corporations rights over people and the rest of it.
Yes.
Billy, Jody talked about progressive grassroots and really raising their voices. Progressive grassroots are up against conservative grassroots forces. The New York Times had a piece in February about 36 of the best financed, most battle-hardened players in the conservative movement, the Koch Network, the NRA, and leading evangelical and anti-abortion groups. And they are putting their differences behind them to join forces to really push for a yes vote for Gorsuch. They're spending a lot of money on TV ads. They've got websites. Very, very organized. So what are your thoughts on this part of the story?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think that those folks think that they know how Judge Gorsuch is going to rule on the issues that matter to them. And you know, those expectations, you know, could be realized if he gets on the bench. I think that we're going to see a lot more progressive groups turning to this issue now that the fight over the Affordable Care Act, is not, you know, going to be raging as strongly as it has been raging the last few weeks. At least that's my hope, that, you know, some of the folks that have been kind of turning their attention to that fight will turn their attention to Gorsuch next. But, you know, time will tell. I mean, I think that the conservatives in general have always had a reputation for putting these judicial issues at the front of their political agenda, but I think that Democrats are really starting to get on board and understand what's at stake with this nomination.
Jody, according to the New York Times, conservative groups are spending about $10 million, and the Washington Post just reported that conservative groups are outspending their liberal counterparts on TV ads by 20-1.
Yeah, you know, we know that there's huge money behind this. We know that the Koch brothers, the Mercers, lots of different groups have tons of money in this administration, as well as on this nomination fight, and among them are the most, you know, radical far right that we know of in this country. But there's one thing and one thing only against which senators and congresspeople, or which senators and congresspeople fear more than the money, which is their votes and the votes of the people in their districts. And that's why I think you saw so many defections from what was in any case a horrible bill, if you could even have called it a bill, on the you know, the American Health Care Act, the so-called American Health Care Act. You know, there was, I think the divisions in the Republican caucus around that bill were not created out of nowhere. They were created by public pressure and by people who were afraid of the voters. And the voters, I think, to me, have rediscovered democracy. So it's not going to be only about money. Of course, money makes a difference because, you have the ads, you have the lobbyists. But it's going to be, and it's left to you, people's voices and people's actions. And I really am hoping that we are going to see that becoming more and more forceful in the next several days.
Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of Rewire, an online publication focusing on sexual and reproductive health. And Billy Corrier is deputy director of legal progress at American Progress. Today, we are talking about Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch. The Democrats want to delay the vote. Right now, it is confirmed for next Monday, April 3rd. You've got Chuck Schumer, Democratic senator, saying that Democrats have the votes to deny Neil Gorsuch the 60 votes he needs to clear a Senate filibuster. But then you have Senator Patrick Leahy saying he's probably going to vote no, but he won't filibuster. So what do you think? Should the Democrats stand up and filibuster and force Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to choose the nuclear option? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And after 3 days of hearings, what did you learn from Neil Gorsuch based on the questions he answered or in many cases refused to answer? If you have any questions about his record, We'd love to hear from you and what kind of Supreme Court justice he would be. He's only 49 years old. He's young. That means he's going to be on the bench for decades to come. He will have a profound impact on the country's political, social, and legal landscape. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Jody, I know you have to leave us in 10 minutes, so I want to focus on some of the issues that Rewire writes about. And Hobby Lobby is one of the cases that is most cited. In that case, Judge Gorsuch sided with the majority in ruling that corporations are people and can refuse birth control coverage to their employees on religious grounds. What are the broader implications of this ruling? And what do you think this says about how he would rule on the bench if he's confirmed?
Well, I think it's a really bad portent for how he would rule on the bench. The implications of the ruling are pretty profound. People tend to take it not very seriously in some quarters, but let's put it this way. If you can't control whether, when, and with whom you have a child, you can't determine the rest of your life. You can't determine your education. You can't determine your work life. You have costs that you might not expect to have. So contraception, you know, apart from the fact that it's proven from a public health point of view, from a public health evidence point of view, across the world to have many public health and individual health benefits, and apart from the fact that there are also medical indications for access to contraception that may not have to do with the birth control piece, it's also a matter of family economics and individual economics. And having a child at a certain time in life as opposed to another time in life, or deciding not to have a child at all, is a critical function of how you live your life, how you express yourself, what you achieve as a person. So denying women access to contraception under an insurance policy, which, let's remember, they are working to earn. In other words, it's been misreported widely that the companies are paying for contraception. What the companies do is offer insurance plans. Many of those insurance plans are actually paid for by the employee, or at least a share of them are paid for by the employee. Why should the company have say over what my insurance covers because of their so-called religious beliefs? So you have a decision in that one decision alone that has major public health implications. It has major medical implications. It has incredible personal implications. And to blithely say that someone can espouse at a corporate level a religious philosophy that trumps the health, economic, and rights aspects of individual lives is, to me, ludicrous on its face. I don't care how many law degrees were involved.
And on abortion, he has not written a court opinion, but the New York Times has a piece about his dissertation, and his limited remarks on Roe are skeptical. He calls Roe v. Wade's logic a, quote, hodgepodge of doctrines and theories, end quote, and refers to abortion as a non-contextual right, meaning it has no basis in the text of the Constitution. Now, Donald Trump has repeatedly said that he would appoint an anti-abortion judge. And based on this New York Times story about these leading evangelical and anti-abortion groups who are putting a lot of money backing Gorsuch, we can assume where he stands on abortion. So, Jody, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, I'm not going to speak for Billy, but I'm sort of assuming we probably both agree that there's a reason there's so much money being poured into this guy's nomination, and there's a reason he was picked and was on the list that was given to Trump by the Heritage Foundation and the others. And that is because they are looking to him, as Billy noted earlier, for certain kinds of decisions and outcomes. And one of the concerns I have is that for all of the talk, when it's convenient, about precedent and that kind of thing, we've seen the Roberts Court not necessarily be, you know, always adhere to precedent. And with respect to Roe v. Wade, the entire right wing would like to call that decision, you know, unsupportable. So I think it's a major blow to the constitutional right to decide what to do with your body and your fertility and your health. I think we have a major danger on our hands. And this is why I think, going back to the Democrats, any Democrat, including Senator Leahy, who espouses to be pro-choice, pro-human rights, pro-voting rights, et cetera, cannot abide by voting for or not filibustering this candidate. That's just my opinion.
Billy, what would you add?
No, I totally agree with that. And I think that, you know, Judge Gorsuch hasn't had a chance to rule on Roe versus Wade specifically. But, you know, in addition to his Hobby Lobby ruling, I think that if you look at his ruling in the Utah Planned Parenthood case, in that ruling, Judge Gorsuch kind of went out of his way to try to get the Tenth Circuit, the court that he belongs to rehear this this case involving the Utah governor's attempt to defund Planned Parenthood. Now, all the other judges who ruled on the case, and the judges in the majority, kind of saw through the governor's pretextual justification for revoking this funding and saw it as an attack on the right to an abortion. And Judge Gorsuch would have taken the governor's word for it and would have allowed him to defund Planned Parenthood. But luckily his views didn't prevail. I think that you can also look at the book that Judge Gorsuch wrote on assisted suicide and euthanasia, in which he also sort of attacks some of the legal principles that underlie Roe versus Wade, sort of like the way that he did in his thesis.
We have a few callers on the line, so let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. There's a couple of things, and maybe this is going to get a little bit too abstract. I'm really wondering what's going on in the minds of the Democrats who are now looking like they might not go for a filibuster. I think that the Democrats should have made it clear, and Schumer should have made it clear to Trump and the Republicans, look, you held up Garland. We are not going to approve somebody who's to the right of Scalia. That's not going to happen. So you better put somebody up here who's moderate, and then we'll have a chance of getting a nominee. But right now, I don't think you can rely on the Democrats. I mean, the Democrats should be just totally behind a filibuster, as Schumer is, and I can't understand Leahy. I mean, this is just... This man is going to, if he gets on the court, I don't think people are going to understand what the country is going to look like when these things come up. And lastly, you know, Trump has got so many conflicts of interest. I think he's violating the Constitution right now. If that kind of case came up and Gorsuch was on the court, how do you think Gorsuch would vote? So I think it'd be a disaster, and I hope that people will get on the Democrats, but I wouldn't keep my fingers crossed about the Democrats stopping this.
Well, thank you for calling in, Greg. Billy, what do you think?
Well, I'm a little more optimistic, I'll have to say. I mean, the statements that we've seen from Democratic senators who have come out with their position since the hearing, I think, have largely been, been good, good statements. Just this morning, we've had a few more Democrats come out and say that they will participate in the filibuster, they'll support the filibuster, or that they will ultimately vote against Gorsuch when he comes to the floor. Senator Leahy and Senator Manchin have both sort of said that they'd support the filibuster. Manchin is not clear how he would actually vote on Gorsuch, but I'm a little more optimistic about where the Democrats are going to come down on this issue.
So Gorsuch needs 60 votes, including the support of at least 8 Democratic senators. Let's say they do filibuster. What would happen?
Well, then they would have to, you know, vote on whether to have cloture, which would end the filibuster, and that requires 60 votes. And then if they don't get 60 votes, they would basically change the Senate rules. This is what they call the nuclear option. They would change the Senate rules to eliminate the filibuster for Supreme Court nominees. So then Gorsuch could be confirmed with just a bare majority of senators.
And Senate Democrats, under the leadership of Harry Reid, when he was majority leader, got rid of the 60-vote requirement on executive and lower court nominations.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, and so how would that apply to this?
Well, when they made those changes a few years ago, they kept Supreme Court justices exempt from the change. I think as a recognition that, you know, this is a lifetime appointment to the highest court in the land, so maybe we should have a higher standard than just a bare majority of senators.
Given the rules and the fact that the Dems have 42 seats in the Senate, could they use every option possible to stop Gorsuch?
Well, I mean, we'll have to see how many senators they have, but I hope that that's the case.
And Jody,
agreed.
I know we have to let you go, but I'm wondering, are there any other cases you've been looking at that haven't gotten much attention that you'd like listeners to know about?
Well, oh gosh, there's tons of them, and you know, and my brain is a little bit fried out today
because we talk a lot about
stepped into a board meeting, but. There are a number of, I'm going to let Billy answer that because he's probably a little bit more coherent than I am right now.
Okay, that's fine. I mean, Hobby Lobby comes up a lot. The truck driver who got caught in freezing weather comes up a lot. There is a disability case, Jody. Are you familiar with this one? In 2008, Gorsuch wrote an opinion that overturned Thompson School District versus Lake. This is a case in which an autistic boy sought funding to be placed in a residential school program that would better serve his development, and Judge Gorsuch ruled that because Luke was viewed to have made, quote, some progress in his education within public school, that environment was sufficient under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And the same day that he was being questioned by the committee, the 8-member Supreme Court ruled, rejected the decision. Are you familiar with that one?
Yes, I am. And I mean, you know, basically what he was saying there is that the minimal amount they give you is enough, whether or not it meets your needs or whether or not it helps the child in question. And there's a certain level, I think, you know, we tend to look at people in terms of personality, look, you know, accomplishments on paper, but there's a real issue here, and President Obama brought it up when he was early in his term in office, the issue of empathy, compassion, and the knowledge of how the law really affects people, actual living people on a day-to-day basis. And with a very, very conservative framework and the tools of the law and a sort of religious bent to how you look at things, you can come out with some incredibly egregious and anti-human decisions. And to me, this was one of those. So you have a man who, again, on paper, looks great, presents well, is obviously very smart, but who doesn't seem to understand the ways in which compassion and lived human experience actually affect real people like a young disabled child.
Well, Jody, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. I'm so sorry to be rushing off.
No, it's fine. Thank you for taking the time.
And thanks, Billy.
Thanks.
Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of Rewire, an online publication focusing on sexual and reproductive health, and they have been extensively covering Neil Gorsuch's confirmation and his record. You can find stories at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after the break, we'll continue speaking with Billy Courier, Deputy Director of Legal Progress at American Progress. We'll also be joined by Bob Agelko, Legal Affairs Reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, it's Reveal. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about the state of retirement in the United States. According to the Economic Policy Institute, the share of families with retirement savings declined after the 2008 recession. In fact, half of all families in the U.S. have less than $5,000 in retirement accounts. So how are you preparing for retirement? That's tomorrow. Today, we are talking about Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says the Dems have the 60 votes needed to clear a Senate filibuster. But Senator Patrick Leahy says, while he's probably not going to vote for Gorsuch, he is probably not in favor of a filibuster. So we're talking about that and Neil Gorsuch's record. Billy Courier is Deputy Director of Legal Progress at American Progress. And now I would like to welcome Bob Agelko to the show. Bob is legal affairs reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. Hi, Bob. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot.
Well, you've got a front page piece in the Chronicle today, and it's called Democratic Opposition Poses Little Threat to High Court Nominee Neil Gorsuch. How do you see this playing out?
I think, you know, fairly similarly to sort of the conventional way of looking at it, although it should be pointed out, as you may have reported already, that the Democrats today succeeded, notwithstanding what I said in my story about a quick committee vote, in putting the committee vote over for a week simply by raising objections, which any member can do. So that's pushing the the calendar back a little. But fact is that even if the Democrats can muster enough votes, 41 votes, to keep a filibuster in place, the Republicans have a majority that can repeal the filibuster and push the nomination ahead through a majority vote, and basically do it permanently, so that future Supreme Court nominees can be confirmed by a majority as well. And they can probably do it in time for Gorsuch to be seated for the April calendar, which there's at least one or two interesting cases, and of course there's other cases looking down the line. You may have already referred to the travel ban, and there's others. There's a very major a public employee union case coming up that we can talk about if you like, but it would restore a 5-4 conservative majority on the court that ended with Justice Scalia's death a little over a year ago, and it's just hard to see the Democrats effectively blocking that. They can do and say certain things in the meantime to maybe educate the public a bit more about who the nominee is, but it's really hard to see how they can keep him off the court.
Hmm. Bob, you have an interesting piece called California's Top Justice Touts Strength of State Courts, and it's about how states can use their own constitution to challenge Supreme Court decisions. And Supreme Court Justice Goodwin Liu says that a state court can provide protection for basic liberties that otherwise would go unprotected in the state. Can you talk about that, what you found there? And this is an angle that hasn't really gotten much attention.
Yeah, well, I think that state justices, it's been something that, you know, liberal majorities on state courts, as the Supreme Court has been conservative in recent decades, have pursued, interpreting state constitutions more protectively than federal ones. Well, we obviously saw that in the same-sex marriage case where California Supreme Court in 2008 interpreted the state constitution to allow same-sex marriage. The voters overturned that, and their action was later overturned by federal courts. But states in general, maybe Massachusetts did it in 2003, have interpreted either parallel or different provisions in their state constitutions to provide greater protection of individual liberties, whether in the criminal context or the civil rights context, than the federal constitution has, and they basically have the authority to do that. And Goodwin Liu, sorry about the headline, he's not the top justice in California, but he's a member of the top court, said that it might be time to take a harder look at the rights that state courts can protect, even when the provisions of their constitutions, like freedom of speech and freedom of religion, are quite parallel to the federal constitution. It's the kind of thing that can encourage the federal courts, as it did in the marriage context, or at least maintain kind of respectful dialogue, whether it's on the authority of police to conduct searches or the rights of individuals as against the government, and various things that constitutions are meant to protect from majorities. And at this point where Republicans have majorities in pretty much all the branches of government, I think Democrats are looking to state courts to use their constitutions as kind of a shield against federal power.
Billy, what do you think about this? Bob also points out in his piece that civil rights activists are looking to the courts in California and other states to rely on their own laws on issues like abortion, gay, and minority rights. There's so many issues. What do you think about this?
Well, I mean, I think he's absolutely right. I think that Justice Liu was, I think that's a very good idea, looking to state courts and state constitutions right now. If Gorsuch gets confirmed, there is going to be a new 5-justice conservative majority on the Supreme Court. But when it comes to state constitutions and the scope of state constitutional rights, the state Supreme Courts have the final say on that issue. And the U.S. Supreme Court can't even overrule them. Just about every state has a right to vote in their constitution, for example. And in some states, that right is broader than the federal right. In some states, it's not. But I think that that's a very good strategy. And the other important point I'd point out is I think a lot of folks are looking to state attorneys general right now to protect their rights as well. A lot of times they're going to go into federal court to try to do that, but I think that's another place where we can kind of look to the state government to try and protect some rights in the Trump era.
Billy Corrier is Deputy Director of Legal Progress at American Progress, and Bob Agelko is Legal Affairs Reporter with the Chronicle. He's got a front page story in today's paper about Democratic opposition to Gorsuch, which a lot of people say they could filibuster, but they just don't have the votes. And we've got another question about that. Let's hear from David in Berkeley. Hi, David.
Hi. I wholeheartedly agree with the previous caller. And wondering why Leahy isn't part of that united stand to filibuster. And we heard, you know, of Frank and Feinstein put out some excellent grilling on Gorsuch. We didn't hear such from Leahy. And he's not in our district. I know if we try to write people outside of our district, our emails are blocked or they're just not, you know, accepting. How do we, I guess to be fair to him, find out why he doesn't want to join, and also how can we influence, how do we contact him so that those who really feel that we should filibuster should at least try to persuade him, because he seems to be the linchpin right there.
Well, thank you for that call, David.
So long.
Billy, what's the best way people can raise their voices on this?
Well, I mean, I think you're right in terms of senators that are outside of your state. You know, it's hard to reach them directly, but I think that speaking out publicly, even if it's just something like writing a letter to the editor, is something that can help. You know, I think a lot of folks across the country speaking out about these issues can move senators in leadership positions, regardless of whether or not those folks are in their state or not. So, I would encourage folks to speak out in whatever way they can on social media, through traditional media, you know, in any way that they can get the word out about Neil Gorsuch.
And same question to you, Billy, that I asked Jody. There have been a lot of reports and a lot of conversations about Hobby Lobby, about the truck driver who sadly got caught in freezing weather. We talked about the Chevron case when you were on last time around. Is there a case that you've been reading about that hasn't gotten much attention?
Well, I think that the disabilities case that you discussed with Jody, I think is one that I find really interesting because it just kind of popped on our radar last week. It was really unusual. You had the U.S. Supreme Court issuing this ruling during Judge Gorsuch's confirmation hearing that really harshly criticized one of Judge Gorsuch's rulings on the disabilities and education issue. It's not every day that a judicial nominee has something like that happen during their confirmation hearing, and I think that Senator Klobuchar and others really grilled him hard on that issue, and I think that, like the truck driver case, it's an example of Judge Gorsuch's rulings being sort of callous and just kind of divorced from the reality of, you know, everyday Americans who face certain struggles.
And what about you, Bob? What cases stand out for you?
Well, I want to say a little bit of something about that disability case because it raised a couple of interesting issues. Judge Gorsuch, of course, was asked about the case during the hearing after the Supreme Court reached its ruling. And the ruling did not directly reverse his decision because there had been later decisions from the same 10th Circuit Court following the same principle. He said, accurately enough, that in 2008 he had just been following binding precedent from, well, relatively accurate, he had just been following precedent from the 10th Circuit, which is true. Previous decisions of a circuit court are binding on panels until the court changes, or until the Supreme Court changes. What he didn't say was, first of all, if you don't like a precedent and you're a member of a court of appeals, you can say something. You can ask, you can make your objections public in your opinion, and you can ask the full court to reconsider letter and reverse it. Jeff Gorsuch has done that in other contexts. He didn't do it here. He expressed some sympathy for the autistic child, as he did for the truck driver, but he didn't say we should take another look at it. The other thing he did was he was bound by a precedent, all right. I think his court had said it in 1998, and it said that as long as you're making some progress, the law is satisfied, and it just said what they called more than de minimis adherence to the law is enough. Gorsuch added the word merely. He said more than merely de minimis is enough. In other words, he seemed to put in a new floor. He said he was following precedent, but he seemed to be recasting it to make it a bit lower. And question how candid was he really being about what the law required? Did he lower the barrier? Because that's what the Supreme Court rejected this time around. So while saying he was bound, he didn't really spell out the things he could have done if he objected. Now it's a little late in the game. He's saying, we sympathize and all that stuff. The time to speak out was perhaps a little earlier when the precedent was on the books, and it might have been for a judge to say something about it.
The ACLU also points to another case about someone with a disability. Assistant Professor Grace Huang worked at Kansas State University for 15 years, and after a cancer diagnosis, she requested and received a six-month leave of absence covering the 2009 semester in the fall while she recovered from a bone marrow transplant. As she was preparing to return to teaching in January, the campus erupted in a flu epidemic. Because a flu infection would have been dangerous given her compromised immune system, she asked for further short leave during which she could have worked from home. The university denied her request and she sued. Under established disability rights law, a request for leave due to a disability must be evaluated on a case-by-case basis. Judge Gorsuch ruled that Professor Huang's request for an additional leave of absence was unreasonable. He asserted that showing up was an essential job function and opined the Rehabilitation Act should not turn employers into safety net providers for those who cannot work. Billy, are you familiar with this case?
Yeah, I'm pretty familiar with the case. Yeah, and I think I think that's absolutely right. I mean, that's another example of Judge Gorsuch ruling against workers. As you mentioned, the statute clearly says that you have to evaluate it on a case-by-case basis, and his ruling sort of suggested that her request was just per se unreasonable. When she actually was facing this really unusual circumstance of a bird flu epidemic breaking out on the campus, which, is not something that happens every day, so it's not an issue that's going to come up often. But Ms. Huang has really spoken out about this case and her experience with Judge Gorsuch, and I think it's yet another example of Judge Gorsuch putting employers over workers.
Bob?
Yeah, I mean, if I remember the case right, he simply said, 6 months is enough. 6 months is long enough. You've had enough. Now it could be, and I don't know all the facts of the case. It could be that the school put forward a persuasive case, but it seemed that, as in the case of the trucker, he didn't kind of when you have any doubts, which way do you lean? Where do your sympathies go? Or you might say that you're sympathetic, but what breaks the tie? And the trucker and his lawyer said he had to decide whether to value the cargo or the person, and he chose the cargo. Here was the school or the ailing, maybe desperately ill employee. He chose the school and its rules. There may have been reasons for that, but it seems like his tie-breaking factors aren't necessarily always human. That's not true in every case. I mean, some of his religious cases, he's ruled for religious minorities as well as the Hobby Lobby people. But when you read some of his rulings and you hear about the dialogue he's had with some of the lawyers, they are trying to elicit sympathy. He will express it only to the point that he says, "Sorry for your loss," and then not break any ties in their favor. So his tie-breaking factors just don't necessarily seem to be in favor of people who might be cast as underdogs, and I think that's what his opponents are are citing him.
Billy, we have a question from a caller. Where does Gorsuch stand on LGBTQ rights? Is there anything in his record that gives us any information on that?
Well, I don't think there's much in his judicial record, except for, you know, rulings on issues sort of tangentially related. But if you look at this blog post that Judge Gorsuch wrote in 2005, just before he became a judge, it's called Liberals and Lawsuits, and it was published on a conservative blog. And in it, he criticizes, you know, what he calls liberal groups for trying to enact their social agenda through the courts. And he mentions marriage equality as one example. So, you know, whenever he looks at a case involving corporations trying to assert some kind of legal right, like Hobby Lobby trying to assert a religious right that, you know, no court had ever recognized for a for-profit corporation, he's, you know, amenable to that kind of claim in court. But at the same time, you know, the year before he became a judge, he's writing about how same-sex couples somehow shouldn't be trying to assert their right to marriage equality through the courts, that it's somehow, you know, not a legitimate thing for them to do.
And also, we have another question about immigrant rights. Bob, earlier in the show, you mentioned that the Supreme Court might hear a case on the travel ban. Is there anything that you've read about Gorsuch's rulings on immigrants that give us a sense of where he stands?
I have seen a post that suggested that Gorsuch does not belong to the extremely conservative faction on issues of immigration, and how that might translate into something on the travel ban, I don't know, because there, you know, one of the significant issues is how deferential are you to executive authority.
Right.
It's certainly been suggested from Judge Gorsuch's record that he would be, you know, pretty deferential to the president's authority in areas where, you know, the law says you should be, immigration, national security, and the like. And the question in this case becomes, what about the evidence of ulterior motive? Is that the kind of how much consideration should one give to evidence as a Muslim ban? And you know, Judge Gorsuch is sometimes what's called a textualist. You go from the you go to the text of the law and try not to look at what might be underlying it, and that might give some encouragement to supporters of the president here. I honestly don't know, though, because there isn't anything, you know, very directly in his record on immigration issues, and he hasn't, you know, ruled on much national security as far as I know. But it does seem that he is considered likely to be deferential, and his record too as a Justice Department attorney in the George W. Bush administration, Guantanamo on issues of interrogation, where he said that aggressive interrogation techniques were producing results, where he basically suggested that Bush say that the ban on inhumane treatment was just reflecting current policies, which included waterboarding, suggests a fairly deferential attitude, at least as an attorney. Whether that would translate as a judge, I suppose we'll probably find out.
Yeah. Billy?
Yeah, and I completely agree with that 100%. I think that if you look back at what the Department of Justice was doing at the time Gorsuch was there, they were really arguing in so many cases that the president had nearly unlimited authority when it came to national security, so that he could do things like waterboard suspected terrorists, and that Congress and the courts couldn't really do anything about it. So they were making these sweeping claims about executive authority, and Judge Gorsuch was helping formulate some of those arguments. And of course, you know, he was sort of doing his job as a DOJ attorney, clearly, but, you know, I think that he wasn't quite forthcoming as he could have been about what he actually did there, about whether or not he pushed back on some of these issues against the folks that wanted these things to happen. I mean, he did acknowledge that he pushed back against the waterboarding issue, but that's only one issue on a whole range of issues of executive power and national security. I mean, I think that if you look at one judge on the Ninth Circuit out in California, Judge Jay Bybee, he was actually at the Department of Justice, and he actually signed one of the first torture memos that came out. And this is a memo that basically allowed the executive branch to start waterboarding and all these other forms of torture. And after he left the Department of Justice, he was confirmed to a seat on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals because the public didn't know that he had signed the torture memo. I'm sure that if that had come out, he would not have been confirmed. But I think that we have to, because that happened, we have to demand that Judge Gorsuch answer a lot of questions about what he actually did at the Department of Justice.
And when will there be time for him to answer those questions?
Well, Senator Feinstein, I believe it was Senator Feinstein, said that she would submit further written questions to Judge Gorsuch on this issue. So there's still time for him to provide more information.
Well, as it stands now, again, the vote is still scheduled for Monday, April 3rd. We've got a lot of people writing in very angry about what's happening. And Billy, I just want to ask you, why do you think the Democrats didn't fight harder to get a hearing for Merrick Garland last year?
I mean, I think that there were Democrats that fought hard. Could they have fought harder? You know, I'm not sure. I mean, I think that historically conservative voters have made the Supreme Court a huge part of their priorities, of their agenda when it comes to politics. Liberals have had a reputation for not doing that as much, but I think that that they are starting to do that more, that they're starting to realize that every issue that they care about, whether it's money in politics, the rights of women, all these issues have to go through the courts. And so they need to speak out against nominees that they feel like do not reflect their values and do not reflect the values of Americans.
What do you think, Bob?
There's a couple of things I'd like to mention that maybe haven't quite come up.
And we have about a minute left.
Okay,
go
quickly,
ahead.
What's coming up in the Supreme Court? Travel ban, a case to be heard in late April on the ability of a religious school to get public aid, in this case for some coding on its playground, but it's you know very significant as to what the government must do or whether it can deny aid to religious schools. And what's coming up sometime in the next year or so, a rerun of the case on public employee union payments, something that could really hurt public employees by allowing non-members to withhold payments on free speech grounds for the cost of representing them at the bargaining table. They fell one vote short with the death of Justice Scalia. A new member would probably rule in their favor and really hurt public employee unions and their Democratic beneficiaries.
Wow. Well, we'll definitely do a show about that. Bob Agelko is legal affairs reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. Check out his front page story today about Neil Gorsuch and the Democrats. Billy Corrier is deputy director of legal progress at American Progress. He's been writing extensively about Neil Gorsuch's record. And you can find those stories at yourcallradio.org. Bob and Billy, thank you both for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about the state of retirement in the United States. According to the Economic Policy Institute, half of all families in the U.S. have less than $5,000 in retirement accounts. So how are you preparing for retirement? That is tomorrow. Your Call is produced here at KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.
Starting next week here on KLW, there'll be some changes to our Midday Monday lineup. At 11 a.m., we'll be bringing you On Point with Tom Ashbrook, with Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting moving to noon. Open Source will move to Sunday afternoons at 4 p.m., and to learn about all of the upcoming changes to KLW's program schedule, visit KALW.org. And tune in this afternoon at 5 for Matt Martin's Manager's Report to the Listeners. He'll be talking all about the changes coming to the KLW schedule. Coming up next today, though, it is Reveal, the Peabody Award-winning program from the Center for Investigative Reporting. This is 91.7 KALW San Francisco. The time is 11 o'clock.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. For decades,
The isolated forests of Northern California provided cover for people growing marijuana illegally.
I think of Petrolia as this little town kind of hanging off the edge of the world. It's very remote.
These days, the pot trade is more out in the open and more dangerous.
I was really saddened, disgusted, scared. Scared for the women in the community, scared for myself a little bit.
The pot boom is sparking a new migration of workers, but it's also drawing sexual predators who are targeting women. Even the police can't protect them.
We have a very high incident of violence in our county, and some people come up to grow and don't go back.
Today on Reveal, hidden outposts where people are exploited for sex. But first, this news.